Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. When most of us think of the Civil War, the role of St. Louis or Missouri may not be the first thing that comes to mind. Fact is, they played a huge role before and during the war. Who knew St. Louis was a significant naval base, that women fought disguised as men, or that General Grant's wife had to deal with Confederate sympathizers in her St. Louis social circle? But that's just a small part of the history. Two local authors have written about that history and rely heavily on personal accounts and the impact of the war on individuals to tell the story. I'm Don Marsh. Joining us in studio to talk about it, historian author Nini Harris. Her book is A Most Unsettled State, First-Person Accounts of St. Louis During the Civil War. James Irwin's book is The Homefront in Civil War, Missouri. He's with me in studio as well. I thank you both so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank
nice to be
you.
Here.
Let me put this out to both of you. Do you think it's an overstatement to say, and I'll start with you, Nini, that most people probably are a little bit surprised at the role our area and this state played in the war?
They don't appreciate it at all. In fact, even during the war, people did not understand in much of the country how critical St. Louis was to waging the war. But what was important was that Lincoln understood it. Lincoln knew New England could not win the war on its own, and that the Union needed what were called then the Western States, which meant Indiana, Illinois, Missouri. And to keep those states with the Union and supporting the Union efforts, he understood as a Westerner you had to rely on the river system. And that meant St. Louis was essential to waging the war for the Union cause.
Jim, your take on all of that?
Well, I agree. And historians have sort of had the same lack of perspective as well. I read somewhere that, why are we having more books on the Civil War? Of course, it's the 150th anniversary. There are 70,000 books on the Civil War supposedly been published over the years. I would say 69,000 of them are about the theaters east of the Appalachians. And maybe 500 west, and very few about Missouri. For example, the first really scholarly book about the guerrilla war in Missouri didn't come out until 1958, and there really wasn't an explosion of books on Missouri or the guerrilla war in Missouri until the late 1980s and 1990s.
I have said on this program, one of our guests had said at one time that there were more battles fought in Missouri than any of the eastern states during the war. I think you have it at third.
It's right? Third after Virginia and Tennessee, but it is third.
Yeah.
It is third.
1,000 battles.
1,162, according to the official count.
I'm not going to argue with you. You are the expert. Nini, you set up the situation just pre-war St. Louis. You write about it so well in the book, and just let people know what it was like here just before all hell broke loose.
Well, we were a foreign city. We had a population of 160,000 people living all very close to the Mississippi River in basically what's downtown now and a little to the north and south of that. 60,000 of the people of St. Louis were born in Germany, almost 40,000 born in Ireland. I found 2,000 people born in Bohemia. There were communities of Swiss dairy farmers on Gravois. There was a steady trickle of French immigrants. The people who were born in the Americas were often generally they were pretty evenly split between the northern states, the middle Atlantic states and the southern states. So they were mixed up in their feelings too. So this was a really vibrant, exciting, diverse community that was built of brick. Even at that time, we had brick streets, brick sidewalks, brick buildings. Commerce hugged the river. The river was the source of everything in this city. It was the reason to exist. And so almost all jobs were directly or indirectly related to the river, because this truly was the gateway to the West. And it was such a remarkable place of so many diverse people coming together. What was maybe most remarkable is we were in a slave state, yet in St. Louis, in the city, we had more free African Americans than we had people living in slavery, because the French, our founders, did practice manumission, or freeing of the slaves. That was not uncommon. So we had a few more free blacks than enslaved, but we had both people living in slavery in the city and people whose heritage had been slavery who were living free.
Jim, how did that match statewide?
Well, it's actually quite a bit different outstate Missouri, at least once you got beyond, say, St. Louis County or St. Charles County, which had a large German population. Most of the white people who lived there came from Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky, places like that, and many of them brought slaves with them. And, of course, that was a major center of slavery in Missouri along the Missouri River, an area called Little Dixie, 6 or 7, 8 counties that's variously defined, runs from about Callaway County around Jefferson City all the way west to Kansas City and the counties on either side of the river. These were major slaveholding counties. Some of the counties had as many as 30% to 40% of the population were slaves. Slavery in Missouri was a little bit different from the way slavery was conducted in the Deep South and Mississippi and Alabama and places like that, because most of the slaves lived on pretty small farms. A large slave owner would have 20 slaves. There were very few that had as many as 100. Many of the farms only had a few. But those that were larger raised a cash crop that was hemp, which was used for rope, which was used for packing of cotton bales. And so they were tied to the southern economy. They raised hemp, shipped it along the Missouri River down to St. Louis, and then down south.
So this creates a situation, a scenario in which, as war approached, we have people with very much divided sympathies.
Yes.
Right. That is totally accurate. It was almost as if St. Louis was on one side of the Civil War and the rest of the state on the other side.
It's because, Nini, was it because of the German population primarily? I know it was a very liberal group primarily and frowned upon slavery. Was that one of the main reasons?
Yes, and they just didn't frown upon it. They were appalled and disgusted by it. They came here for democracy and liberty. Many of them were 48ers, people who had fled Eastern Europe after their revolutions in 1848 to gain democracy there had failed. So to come here determined to participate in democracy and to witness slavery was just something they could hardly comprehend it, yet stomach it. It was just appalling to them.
Why did they come here? I mean, why did all of them come here, all the groups that you mentioned?
Well, for instance, the Bohemians, when they were able to leave after the Revolution of 1848, they had advertisements in the papers in Austria, which controlled Bohemia at that time, saying that this was the land of milk and honey. Land was cheap here and fortunes were good. And before the railroad, the Mississippi was the path into the center of the United States. So we were the pathway. Once again, we were just the natural place of because of the transportation system.
So, Jim, this is a setup. This is what it was like on the eve of the Civil War. There had to be, and there obviously was, a great debate in this part of the world with regard to secession. Give us some sense of that.
Well, of course, after Lincoln's election, a number of states in the South seceded. The governor of Missouri, Claiborne Fox Jackson, was really in favor of secession, although he kept it very quiet during the election. He called for a convention to be held in St. Louis in March of 1861 to consider secession. And there were elections all over the state to send representatives to that to decide whether Missouri should secede or not, or what it should do. Representatives from the southern states came up to speak to the convention to try to convince Missouri to join other slave states and join the Confederacy. But most Missourians at the time did not really want to secede. In fact, the convention voted 98-2 to remain in the Union. Once things got a little hot in St. Louis, though, with the Camp Jackson affair and so forth, then Missouri, or some Missourians, many Missourians, decided to go over formally to the Confederate side, join the Confederate armies, and participate in the war. Although Missouri itself was never actually part of the Confederacy. Well, I say technically it was. A rump legislature voted to secede in late 1861, and they did send representatives to the Confederate Congress, but practically speaking, it was always controlled more or less by the Union.
You have some numbers in your book, and I don't want to trust my memory, with regard to the number of Missourians who fought for the Union and those who fought for the Confederacy.
About 109,000 are said to have fought for the Union. About 30 to 40,000 for the Confederacy. The records there are not as well kept. They're much more fragmentary. Probably does not include those who fought for the Confederacy on the guerrilla side. And I don't believe the 109,000 includes others in Missouri who fought on the Union side. There was a special force called the Missouri State Militia that was organized with an agreement between Governor Gamble and President Lincoln, where the federal government paid for the cost of the state militia that was only to be used in Missouri to fight guerrillas. And there was also a group called the Enrolled Missouri Militia, and every male between the ages of 18 and 45 was supposed to join this Enrolled Missouri Militia. Or you had the option of declaring yourself to be disloyal, in which case you didn't have to join, but of course you publicly declared yourself disloyal.
That doesn't sound like a good thing.
Right. About 50,000 men were involved in the Enrolled Missouri Militia at one time or another. So considerable number of men. That doesn't even include the African Americans who joined the Army.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later. I have to take a break now. And Nini, when we come back, I'm going to talk about what this discussion was like here in St. Louis when all of this was going on. But I will take that break. We're talking about the Civil War in Missouri and the role that Missouri and St. Louis played in the Civil War, I should say. My guests in studio are author historian Nini Harris. Her book is titled A Most Unsettled State, First-Person Accounts of St. Louis During the Civil War. Also with me is James Irwin. His book is The Home Front in Civil War, Missouri. Back to continue that conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on the role of St. Louis and Missouri during the Civil War with author historians Nini Harris and Jim Irwin. But here first are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The St. Louis Walk of Fame in the Del Mar Loop is getting the first of three new stars. Former Cardinals catcher Tim McCarver gets today's honor. McCarver helped the Cardinals win two World Series in 1964 and in 1967. McCarver went on to be a baseball announcer and was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2011. Honeysuckle may seem to be a prosaic, fragrant flower that smells of summertime, but Missouri is seeing an overabundance of honeysuckle, and it's becoming a big problem. The invasive species is pushing out native plants in the undergrowth of the state's forests. And Missouri's primary election is tomorrow, and on our website you can learn about the amendments and candidates by using our voting guides. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Jim Irwin and Nini Harris. Nini, how about that dialogue in St. Louis during this period of the earliest days of the Civil War? Actually, the earliest days prior to the Civil War, matter of days, actually.
Well, there wasn't much dialogue. Everyone had taken their sides, but no one really knew who was going to be in control. The old hierarchy of St. Louis, they were economically and culturally tied to the South, and they really didn't comprehend the strength of these immigrants. And they were having their meetings, and they were organizing their troops and volunteers. Then you had groups with the Blairs. The Blair family was organizing union forces and supporters here. Lots of secret late-night meetings. In fact, William Tecumseh Sherman is a civilian living in St. Louis running a streetcar line, and he gets a meeting to go to 14th and Washington at 10 o'clock at night to Frank Blair's house for a secret meeting. And these are going on night after night. Then you have the public meetings that are by ward. And at those meetings, people are taking their positions and speaking out for the union. One of the surprising figures I found was James Eads, because I knew him as a great engineer and the man who built the bridge, but before that built the ironclads that Ulysses S. Grant used to clear the Mississippi for the Union. Well, I stumbled upon him giving a speech at Soulard Market, and that he was celebrating the Germans and these rallying clauses, and they're waving flags, and he's saying, you are the ones who are saving our Union. Where are the native-born Americans who don't appreciate the freedom that this country has given them?
Jim, wasn't Missouri trying to remain neutral in all of this?
Yes. Missouri was most Missourians did not want to get involved in the war, did not want to secede, but did not necessarily want to attack the South either. Missouri was trying to remain neutral, but given the position of St. Louis and its importance to the war effort for either side, both sides, it was just impossible for Missouri to remain neutral. It just wasn't something that was going to happen.
You know, when you think about St. Louis again on the river, to realize how important it was, all you have to do is think, if St. Louis had not become a Union stronghold, how would the Union have waged the war in the West? Where would they have waged it from? And you realize the stakes here were enormous, and that's why the Blairs were working secretly and in Lincoln's behalf to organize these Union forces here.
Yeah, the river obviously was key. And Jim, again, I think people will be surprised when Nene mentioned Mr. Eads and the ironclads, if you will be surprised at the naval history here during this period.
Yes, he'd made a proposal to build ironclads. Others had designed them, but he built them down in Carondelet. I believe it was 7. He built the first in, within weeks of signing the contract. One of the ironclads that he built was based on what he called a submarine. Before the war, he had been involved in taking snags out of the Mississippi River, and this boat was what I would call a catamaran. It had two hulls, and they had sections. And so if a cannonball went through one of them, why, they could close it off and it wouldn't sink, unlike most steamboats and even the ironclads that had very shallow drafts, put a hole in the hull of those and they go down right away. In any event, he covered that over, put a deck in between them so that they make that into an ironclad as well. And that was just, I'm trying to remember exactly how many he did. I think 7 of one kind and 6 or 7 of the others. He even designed a turret that was better than the one that was used on the USS Monitor. He was quite an engineer, and I think he was basically a self-taught engineer.
The Monitor and the Merrimack are really the only ironclads that I think most people hear of with regard to the Civil War.
Right, but the War in the Waters, which I think is the title of a book by James McPherson, was very important for controlling the Mississippi, and not just the Mississippi, but the Tennessee and the Cumberland River, which went down into Tennessee and all the way into northern Mississippi.
You think of the strategic element here with the river. I mean, we all have heard of the Battle of Vicksburg, and it's treated in the book, quite pronouncedly. Mm-hmm. But look where the Mississippi River goes, right through the heart of the South.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when Union got control of the Mississippi River, they cut the Confederacy in half and cut off supplies, and it was a devastating blow to the Confederacy.
And that was Grant's understanding of the river that led to that. And he understood how to use those ironclads. And that was what was so important with him, was knowing how to use those boats. There's something about Eads that just fascinates me, though. What a businessman. What an organizer. He turned around that first contract to build ironclads in 100 days. Now, We have many wonderful employees at Boeing here, but can you imagine Boeing even managing to negotiate a contract in 100 days, yet produce these brand new revolutionary war machines and have them on the river?
I think something like that went on during World War II, or the early stages there, because when industry got together and started making, instead of cars and refrigerators, tanks and airplanes, obviously that changed things to a very large degree. I think we ought to talk about Fort Jackson. You alluded to it a little while ago, Nini. The war started, as I recall my dates, in the middle of April of 1861, correct?
Correct.
And Camp Jackson affair was about a month after that.
Correct.
Nini set it up. What was going on here?
Well, troops are organizing for the Union volunteers, particularly in the German neighborhoods. State troops who support secession are camped at St. Louis University, right near where we are now, Grand Center. And they had actually wanted to get closer into the city, but the Union volunteers had already secured those areas. What they wanted was the arsenal on South Broadway, the arsenal that today we know as right across from Anheuser-Busch Brewery, okay? That park and the defense mapping industry there was all part of that arsenal. And the Confederate, or they were not Confederate yet, the secessionists wanted control of that arsenal and control of those arms that could outfit a small army.
Considerable amount of weaponry.
This was a very important facility. And so you have troops in the neighborhoods now along the river supporting the Union. The secessionist by St. Louis University, and the Union forces decide to act first, and in overwhelming forces, volunteers march out the city streets and surround the secessionist here at Grand Center.
Hadn't they already removed the weapons and the ammunition
removing the arms. So it's an interesting saga in this city's story because it's more emotional than it is of real strategic importance in the end. What is important that comes out of it is that the secessionists realize that all these volunteers in St. Louis are truly committed to the Union and that they will act. And that's what comes out of it. These troops march out here. They encircle the camp. The secessionists, they surrender. But as they're marching them back into the city, a riot ensues. Their supporters, the secessionists, line the streets and are screaming at the Union volunteers, calling them the damned Dutch, actually damned Deutsch, but they probably mispronounced it Dutch, and that's where we get scrubby Dutch and all. But they're yelling at them and throwing rocks, and basically it's a riot. Who fired the first shot? Everyone has a different story.
But 28 dead?
Correct.
Jim, your take on this and the role that this particular incident had in kind of galvanizing, if you will, attitudes.
Well, the governor and the state legislature had been batting around the adoption of a bill for a creation of the militia. And as soon as this happened, this became another hot topic. Within a month, I guess, after this, because of the violence that occurred in Missouri, they had a meeting here in St. Louis to discuss what they should do, if there's something they could do to avoid further violence. The governor and his general Price, wanted to have this federal troops basically remain only in St. Louis and not go out state. General Nathaniel Lyon, who was the commander of the Union troops, said, "You can't tell me what to do with federal forces, and this means war." And so they immediately went back to Jefferson City. The legislature passed a law creating a militia, the Missouri State Guard. Within a week, Lyon was on the riverboats all the way up to Jeff City to run the legislature out of the Capitol and start with the first battles in Missouri, the Battle of Boonville on June 17th or June 19th, anyway, around mid-June of 1861. The Camp Jackson affair was probably what made everyone in Missouri realize that neutrality was just not going to happen in Missouri. It was going to, there was going to have, people were going to have to take sides. Yeah.
There was a lot of outrage about it, but what actually happened was much smaller than the results,
yes.
The ripple effect. And you read all these wild descriptions, but what you just said about the effect throughout the state, the attitudes changing, that was what was important that came out of Camp Jackson, not who fired the first shot.
Yeah, as is so often the case in historical perspective, sometimes the trigger is a relatively minor situation.
A curiosity, though, is that that was William Tecumseh Sherman's introduction to the Civil War, was here on the streets of St. Louis with his 7-year-old son at his side and his brother-in-law, with him. They walked out to watch the secessionist being marched back into the city as prisoners, and the bullets started flying, and they threw themselves to the ground to not be hit and heard the bullets cutting the leaves above their heads. So his introduction to the war is in Midtown St. Louis.
And for people who have forgotten their history, William Tecumseh Sherman is the man who marched through Atlanta at one point during the Civil War, and the rest of it, as they say, is history.
Right.
Quite a character. You know, I'd like to talk about some of the personalities that come up in your books. Again, folks may not realize that General Lee had a history here in St. Louis long before the Civil War, but nonetheless, he was here with the Army Corps of Engineers, I believe. You're nodding, Nene.
Yes.
He was protecting our riverfront. The river was much wilder and wider and moving around more. And it was essential to trade in the United States that that channel be clear and that the river go along our riverbank. And so he had been stationed here with the Army Corps to secure that riverbank. And he was a great engineer at doing that.
And, Jim, if Ulysses Grant recognized the importance of the river to the war, I'm sure Robert E. Lee did as well, having had that background.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Of course, he was in the Eastern Theater, but certainly he did, yes.
Yeah. Did you want to add something?
Well, Grant had an overall strategy for the nation that included the river system. And even when he goes east and takes command as a lieutenant general of all the Union armies, he has a strategy that includes the west and cutting through the south, whereas Lee ends up just in that Virginia area, very limited in his impact, really.
Another name that pops up and is a familiar one to people who remember their history is John C. Fremont. What role did he play?
Fremont was appointed by President Lincoln to command in Missouri in July of 1861. He spent a lot of his time trying to organize the troops here in Missouri because the Union troops, frankly, were somewhat chaotic condition in terms of equipment. What he's best known for, though, is what I would call Fremont's Emancipation Proclamation. There had been a number of problems with guerrillas, beginning of the guerrilla war in August of 1861, attacks on trains, burning bridges, and so forth. And he declared martial law, and as part of his declaration, he said that those who were caught doing those kinds of things could be tried and executed. But also as part of that, he said that anyone who was found to be in rebellion was going to have their slaves freed. Well, this went way beyond what President Lincoln was willing to do at the time. At that time, he was in negotiations with the folks in Kentucky. He was concerned about Kentucky going to the Confederacy, and he was afraid that Fremont's declaration of freedom for slaves of those in rebellion would throw Kentucky to the Confederate side. So he wrote Fremont and asked him to please withdraw that part of his proclamation. He didn't have a problem with the other parts. Fremont refused, and he said, "I will do it, but only if you publicly order me to do it." The president complied, and he did publicly order him to do it. It caused a lot of controversy. Those on the abolitionist side were horrified that the president would take such actions and had been praising Fremont. Fremont did not last much longer in Missouri. He was eventually, within a month or two, he was removed by Lincoln and replaced with another general. But that was the first Emancipation Proclamation, if you will, was in Missouri. It didn't last long. Apparently, the only persons who actually got freed by it were a couple of slaves who belonged to Thomas Snead, who I believe was the lieutenant governor of Missouri. And they, before anybody else could be freed, the proclamation was withdrawn.
Nina, this must have been something in the city where you had freed slaves and slaves. I mean, within proximity, obviously.
After Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, the situation in St. Louis becomes all the more confusing because the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 did not apply to slaves in Missouri because officially Missouri was not in rebellion against the nation. So St. Louisans who held slaves could still keep them enslaved. Meanwhile, we had sometimes on the same streets as people living enslaved, we had barracks for freed blacks who were volunteers in the Union Army. So, and then you have refugees flooding in from the southern states that are in rebellion, and they were officially freed. So you had freed slaves from the Deep South who came here as refugees, people living in slaves, and African-American soldiers in blue. I just cannot comprehend even one block in the city at that time and what it was like with the mix of situations people were forced to live in.
Jim, that's another chapter that many people don't know about, and that is the black soldiers in the Union Army.
Right. many of the slaves in Missouri didn't wait for the Emancipation Proclamation or any other kind of formal proclamation. They fled their masters, and they fled to the Union Army. And for years, beginning in as early as 1861, up through the end of the war, the Union Army was puzzled about what to do about it because these were slaves. They were not supposed to be, you know, they were in a slave state. They weren't technically legally free, and yet they came to the Union Army's lines, and many of those in the Union Armies did not want to send them back to their masters. Well, by 1863, Congress did approve the recruitment of blacks, of slaves, for the U.S., what they called the U.S. Colored Troops, and including in Missouri, although the first recruits in Missouri were actually recruited into what was called the 3rd Arkansas Infantry Colored, because they did not want to give it a name of Missouri, because Missouri was still a politically touchy situation. Nonetheless, these were converted over into U.S. Colored Troops regiments. Many of the men from the Missouri, many slaves fled to Kansas and joined Union troops over there, or Iowa. Missouri, after all, was basically almost surrounded by free states, Kansas, Iowa, Illinois. Many went and joined troops in those states. In Missouri alone, something like 40% of the eligible male slaves joined the Union Army. They were trained, housed at Benton Barracks here in St. Louis, up near what's Fairgrounds Park. Fairgrounds Park, and the conditions were really pretty horrible, particularly during the winter of 63-64. But they did serve. Most of them were sent down to Louisiana, where most of their service was in that area around Louisiana and Texas. And one of the regiments, the 62nd Regiment, made up of Missouri troops, fought in the last battle of the Civil War in Texas in May of 1865.
I can't imagine being captured down in Louisiana was a good thing for a black Union soldier at that time. I have to take another break now. We'll come back and continue our conversation with author historians Nene Harris and Jim Irwin. And we'll take your calls as well. 382-8255 is the number. If you have questions about this period, we'd love to hear from you. That's 382-TALK, if you can remember it that way better. Or if you'd like to send us an email, do so at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on Missouri and St. Louis's role in the Civil War. Jim, let me come back to you. You've mentioned it a number of times. There have been a few movies made about the guerrilla raids. Mm-hmm. Who were these guerrillas?
Well, there were three categories of guerrillas. The best known, the ones that people think about when they think of guerrillas, what I would call the freelance guerrillas, were men like William Quantrill or Bill Anderson. They were not part of the Confederate Army. They weren't really under the Confederate Army. They weren't under command of the Confederate Army. They didn't take orders from the Confederate Army. They were groups that ranged anywhere from half a dozen to a dozen to sometimes 50. Sometimes they gathered in groups of 400 or 500. For example, Quantrill's raid on Lawrence was about 400 men. And they roamed the countryside all over Missouri, primarily western and southern Missouri, going where their families lived, and they would raid federal troops, raid towns, raid convoys, mail steamboats. Second group was probably a lot lesser known in Missouri, and certainly I didn't know that much about it until I started doing some research, and these were recruiters. And these were Confederate officers who were sent into Missouri primarily in the summer of 1862 to recruit men for the Confederate Army into northern and central Missouri. Many of the tactics they engaged in were similar to what the guerrillas did, like Quantrill and Anderson and others, and so they were considered guerrillas by Union troops in many respects. But they actually fought pitched battles on occasion with Union troops. And the third group were raiders. They were actually just Confederate cavalry that operated out of northern Arkansas into southern Missouri. Sometimes they were considered to be guerrillas, but they were actually really Confederate soldiers. The ones we think of are the first group, the freelance guerrillas.
Wasn't Jesse James part of Quantrill's crowd?
Yeah, Jesse James, when 16 years old, his mother wouldn't let him join the guerrillas until he was 16. In 1864, he joined what was Fletch Taylor's band and later became an important member of Bill Anderson's band. I actually have a photograph in a book taken of Jesse James when he was 16 years old, probably in July of 1864 in Platte City, Missouri. He participated in the massacre at Centralia, Missouri on September 27, 1864, the Battle of Centralia, which took place later that day. And he became a good friend and admirer of Bill Anderson and of one of his lieutenants, a man named Little Archie Clements, who was very short, hence the name Little Archie, but he was also one of the most vicious guerrillas. He was well known for taking scalps of his victims. Jesse James and his brother Frank were both guerrillas. Frank was actually a guerrilla before Jesse.
Yeah. Nina, you looked like you wanted to get into that.
All these raids throughout Missouri profoundly affected St. Louis in that every time there was a raid, there was another wave of refugees. Mm-hmm. And St. Louis was a city in which was empty of many of its young men because they had gone off to fight with the armies. But it was filled with people coming into this city without any resources whatsoever. And it was only the generosity of St. Louisans that was there to take care of all these refugees. Many of them were slaves who were coming into the city, former slaves. Some even walked here barefoot. Many small farmers fled because of the violence in their counties. So St. Louis was overwhelmed with refugees during this era. Yeah.
And it wasn't just generosity. There was also some compelled generosity. Those who were known to be Confederate sympathizers were subject to assessments, whereas their property was seized and sold to pay for the cost of taking care of the refugees, particularly in the first wave of refugees that came in 1861 mm-hmm. and early 1862.
And some members of the Western Sanitary Commission, however, asked for the assessments to stop because they said, as hard as it is to care for all these people, we're still concerned about the animosity that the assessments are causing.
Right, as in many measures of that nature taken during a guerrilla war, it sometimes has unintended consequences. And one of the unintended consequences was that those who were opposed to the Union became even more bitterly opposed to it.
We have some calls. I'd like to get into the conversation here.
Sure.
And the first one will be from Anthony calling from St. Louis. Anthony, go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Hi. I had read somewhere that there maybe was a Confederate prison downtown at Shodo and Tucker Avenue where the Farina building was, or is. And I was wondering if your guest could maybe back that story up.
Yes. That's the Gratiot Street Prison. It used to be the McDowell Medical College. It was taken over by the Union during the Civil War. It was located where you said. It's where down where the Purina headquarters are, right where the overpass is with the, to the MacArthur Bridge, right in that area. It was operated throughout the war. There were several other smaller places around St. Louis that were used for prisons or hospitals for prisoners. There was also a prison in Alton, Illinois. Where many prisoners were kept.
The old Lynch Street slave market was converted to a prison for Confederate soldiers, which is certainly ironic.
Yes.
But what's curious is that area between, like, Ralston Purina and Bush Stadium, that is the area where John C. Fremont's headquarters were. That's the area where there were barracks for free colored troops. It is also the area where people were living enslaved. So when you go to the stadium, you are walking on turf that was truly made sacred by our ancestors.
Another call. Tim will join us from St. Louis. Go ahead, Tim.
Hello. Hello. That's a great show because those who say if you don't understand history, it's going to repeat itself. So my question is, there's an historic antagonism between St. Louis and the rest of the state, and I'm glad you mentioned that Jesse James seg. I was recently looking at that. My question is, what do the historians think is the link between this whole era and what was going on in the rest of the state, and maybe the link to now the antagonism between the rest of the state and St. Louis, and am I making too much of a leap?
I don't think you are. I think we feel the results of the Civil War every day in the government of our city and our state. If you look at it, just our police department, I am a citizen of the city of St. Louis. My entire life, I have paid taxes to support my police department, but only in the last year does my city government control the police department we pay for it. That all goes back to the Civil War. In the spring of 1861, when the governor of Missouri took over the St. Louis City Police Department. So I think this is a very powerful force in our city and state operations.
I'll take another call. We'll bring in Jeff calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hey, thank you. I have kind of a trivial question, but also I'd like to make a comment about Jesse James after my question. The question is, in that number of 1,162 battles, officially recorded battles, does that make a distinction between full-on battles and skirmishes, and does it include guerrilla clashes? And my comment about Jesse James is, though he's sort of celebrated as a heroic figure, I think we need to remember that in addition to being a cold-blooded murderer, he was a virulent, unabashed racist.
Yes, he was. And the number, the number 1162 includes various, they classified things as scouts or patrols, expeditions, sieges, and so forth. That's included in the 1162. There were about 950 battles, skirmishes. These are based upon Union records, what the Union soldiers recorded as clashes with Confederate troops or with guerrillas. It does include the guerrillas. It doesn't necessarily include guerrillas' attacks on civilians or towns where they weren't involved directly with federal troops. About 950 actual clashes between troops and guerrillas.
And the time that's left, I want to get to a couple of other things. And one of them is, Jim, I'll go to you for this to start, is the role of women during the war. They had a very diverse role, did they not?
Well, they did. the men were off at the war. The women were left to those in the countryside were left to run the farms. The men were either in the guerrilla bands or they're in the armies. In the cities, the women, particularly those in the, I would say, the mercantile elite and others in the city of St. Louis, helped to organize the Western Sanitary Fair. They worked in the hospitals. One of the women, one of the well-known women in the city, Adeline Cousins, actually went down to the battlefields and provided medical services to the troops. They worked on the steamboats, the hospital ships that came back from the battlefields to St. Louis. Some of the women actually joined the army disguised as men. Not really sure how many. Obviously, they were in disguise, but it's probably in the hundreds.
You have a picture of one of them.
Yes, we do. Yeah, Francis Clayton is probably the most famous one from Missouri. But there were others. We don't know the names. We know the names of just a very few because it hasn't always, you know, obviously, for obvious reasons, we don't know.
And they were couriers as well.
And they were couriers, yeah. Particularly you couldn't write to somebody in the South legally. And so they would end up having to smuggle letters to their families from Missouri down to the men in Vicksburg or wherever they might be. And if they got caught, they could be tried by military commissions and either banished from the state or put in jail.
Right. This brings me to Julia Dent Grant, Nini. She was in a very interesting position, being the wife of the commanding general of the Union Army. She lived here. And many of her friends were sympathizers with the South. That had to be very difficult for her.
And they just could not believe that she could really be loyal to the Union. They would say to her, "We know how you were raised. We know where your real feelings are." And this put her in a terrible predicament in trying to gently deal with neighbors, some of whom their husbands were off fighting against her own husband. So it was a very tense situation for many people. In fact, I'm often amazed with everything going on in the city, it's remarkable how civil people were and that business continued, work continued, that they used this area for a staging area for the Western Theater, and the city was literally converted into a hospital for the Union Army. And all this goes on while neighbors are so tense with one another.
We have a caller. I'm not going to take the call because of time considerations, but asking, didn't all or part of Callaway County secede from both sides, and is this how Kingdom City came about?
The story is a little different from that in truth. There was an agreement reached between the Union General John Henderson and a Confederate or secessionist, I guess you'd say politician. He wasn't actually in the Confederate Army to allow his men that had been the Confederates to go back to their homes without interference. That's sort of been converted into a treaty. It was more or less just an agreement that wasn't kept for very long, and creating the so-called Kingdom of Callaway, which of course is the slogan of Callaway County these days. Callaway County was in fact a very pro-secessionist area, and yes, there was that. There is that story out there. I actually tell the story in my book about in more detail.
We only have about a minute and a half left. Nini, in all of your research, what is the thing that jumps out at you most prominently?
The kindness in the city. Again, during such horrible times, people kept working with kindness to make life more bearable for the widows, the orphans, the wounded. It's just incredible. It is incredible that a city that was suffering so much did not crumble into just a quagmire, but instead people rose up and did good things.
And Jim, how about you?
What impressed me is what a small world it was in those days. Everyone on both sides knew everyone on the other, or they were related to them. The Blair family related to a Confederate general. It was amazing. I mean, you hear this story about brother against brother. That happened. It did happen, but it was neighbor against neighbor as well. And that's what impressed me. Everyone seemed to know everyone else.
There are two quotes that I'd like to get clarification on, but it has to be very quick. Did Lincoln actually say, "As Missouri goes, so goes the Union"? He is said to have said that.
I haven't seen that.
All right. Well, we don't know. There was another line, and this came up in your book, Ninny, about Julia Grant. There was complaints about General Grant's drinking. And Lincoln is supposed to have said, according to that in your book, whatever General Grant is drinking, I want to get it to my other generals.
Julia says that Lincoln said that, and I'm not going to disagree with Julia now.
Right.
Whatever she says, I'll roll with now.
You have a very quickly, you have a signing coming up this weekend?
This Saturday at Hammond's Books, 1939 Cherokee Street.
We can learn more at that time.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Nene Harris and Jim Irwin, for being with us. We've got to run, but it's fascinating stuff.
Right.
More information on our website. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the fact and fiction of artificial sweeteners, and we'll also take a look at the growing use of online higher education. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.